If you're just tuning in, this is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Sabine Pooks. Our guest on today's Kenai Conversation is Homer author Tom Kazaya. He just released his newest book, Cold Mountain Path, about the history of McCarthy, Alaska. And a reminder that you can call us with your questions. Our number is 283-8414. That's 283-8414. So you mentioned community, being part of the community and also writing about a community. And of course, you did that on the Kenai Peninsula for a while when you were writing for the Anchorage Daily News. And I want to talk a little bit about that part of your career, because Kenai, of course, isn't a ghost town. But like McCarthy, it's been subject to boom and bust cycles in kind of this specific instance in fishing and in oil. I mean, were you thinking at all about the Kenai Peninsula? Obviously, you live in Homer, so I'm sure there was a little bit of thought to this, but were you thinking about the peninsula when you were writing about McCarthy at all, or kind of do you see any parallels between those boom and bust cycles, between these two pretty different places within Alaska?
Yeah. Well, you know, as I said, with the new cars story, my interest kind of flipped to the part left behind and you know, seeing I think now coming up here today, it's actually made me think more about it than when I was writing, you know, about the sort of back end of the Cook Inlet oil period, and what's pending, what's going on now, how that all plays out and what grows up in the soil left behind, you know. I did say somewhere in the book that the whole experience of Kennecott being abandoned. I mean, there are lots of ghost towns all over Alaska, and most of them have kind of practically disappeared. You know, fallen down and from mining and fishing, old cannery towns, and so a lot of that's gone. But Kennecott was so much bigger. It kind of stands out in that way. Just the scale of the effort to get a 200-mile railroad into the Wrangell Mountains and then to extract all this high-grade copper and build a whole town around it. It's so much bigger. And then there was like important historical lessons from all of that too, you know, like I think there was at the Constitutional Convention, Bob Bartlett gave a great speech saying, you know, Kennecott just came up and took everything, and Wall Street bankers and stuff just grabbed what they could and then left and left us with nothing but a hole in the ground. And there was no, in the territorial days, there was no taxing authority. There was no way to get anything out of it for Alaska. They just kind of took and left overnight. And they didn't want to have that happen again. And so during that period in the 50s, they were writing these resource policies about state control of resources that really gave us the permanent fund and permanent fund dividends. I mean, you can sort of draw a pretty direct parallel to politicians being really, you know, unhappy about, you know, angry about Kennecott and how they left Kennecott Copper, to today, you know, back when politicians saw the exploitive corporations from outside as being a problem rather than being somehow somebody who's providing a lot of campaign contributions and setting them up as friendly legislators. Well, so,
and the imagery of these people leaving Kennecott at the beginning of the book is these scenes of these people just kind of leaving all their things in their houses, and then folks who come to McCarthy later actually go in and kind of go shopping for possessions.
I could use one of those.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah. And there's that mansion that you meant, that the very opulent mansion. Those images are so are so compelling of kind of people just rushing out of this place. Mm-hmm. And then what kind of comes in to, you know, fill that void later on.
And I do think that it has a special resonance in Alaska because yeah. we are, you know, we do have this ingrained fear of becoming a ghost state where, you know, the resources give out and we haven't done anything to prepare for a future without them, and therefore the companies leave and we have to sort of shut the lights out and all follow them back to the rest of the world. And I mean, there's that that kind of lurking fear that's always there in any sort of chamber of commerce luncheon.
Right. Well, and the wariness, but also acknowledgement that it is the next wave is the tourism that kind of comes in after in McCarthy. I mean, McCarthy is a very popular destination for tourists out of state and for young people. You know, in South Central, a lot of them will go up to McCarthy on the weekends and in the summer. And, you know, obviously on the Kenai Peninsula and in Homer especially, there's a lot of tourism. And I don't know, there's almost that parallel between these places as well, that kind of second wave.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I think that there is a life after the resource booms, but of course, and I think you find communities that opposed the creation of the national parks back in the 70s that are now big supporters of their local park because that's kind of driving the economy. You know, McCarthy's still hard to get to, yeah. and far away, and so that has made it has kind of slowed the pace of change out there. It's still kind of a locally driven economy. It doesn't have quite the it doesn't have bus tours coming in, and someday that will maybe change too. But it's nice. But back in the day that I was writing about, you know, the only way you could get into McCarthy was on a hand pulled tram. They didn't have. They briefly had a bridge that they put in when they built the rough road over the old railroad right away. But the bridge washed out. You know, once a year they have this great yokelup that comes out of the glacier. There's an ice dam that gives way and there's a huge flood. And as predicted, it knocked out the wooden bridge right away. So the only thing left was this cable that ran across this, you know, raging whitewater, and with a little cart on it, and you would pull yourself across. And so it took a certain dauntless tourist to find their way to McCarthy. And one of the people out there refers to it was the perfect self-administering interview system.
Well, I love that reminds me that the nature in this story is almost like a character of its own, right? Like the fact that the you know, the flooding is almost, you know, forcing people out as much as the people who don't want anyone else to come in. It kind of plays its own role in keeping people away, which is so interesting. But and as you mentioned, it's still hard to get to McCarthy, but there is a way for cars to get in that there didn't used to be. For people who haven't been, what is McCarthy like nowadays? Mm.
Well, it's, you know, still on the far side of the Kennecott River. So finally, the tram traffic got to be too much in the 90s. But the community still didn't want a bridge in there, so they put a footbridge across the river. And so that's the way you can sort of walk in. And then there were a couple of vans that would shuttle people around in town and up to Kennecott. Eventually, some of the private folks out there put a road bridge further downriver, but they have a really high tariff. You know, there's a toll bridge but you basically buy an annual pass for a few $100. So basically, it meant people who were building cabins and living on the other side of the river could get their materials back and forth, but the average tourist wouldn't use that bridge to drive into McCarthy because there's, you know, there's some old mining roads around there, but there's not a lot of road, and especially up at Kennecott, that you can hardly turn around if you drive up there. So it does not, it's not a place that can just absorb all the road energy that Alaska tourism has. I mean, you see what happens. You can't even find a place to park on the Homer Spit in the summer anymore, you know. And so if some of that energy gets drained on McCarthy, you can see how overwhelming it would be to the ambience of the place. As they said in the past, you know, if you could drive to McCarthy, it wouldn't be here. You know, the defense of not building a good road in was that tourists deserve the opportunity, if they want to go to the effort, to visit a place that's different, that has this kind of qualities. And the response to that was, well, you're just trying to keep a private playground for yourselves. Everybody has the right to come and should have the right to come and visit you, and visit that place. So that's a tension that has no perfectly right and wrong answer, but you do give up the unique qualities of the place if it, you know, if you allow the world full access, access being the kind of key to it all.
Well, it's really interesting too, because of course a lot of these people who are living and who make up this community, they come from all over the place, and they are, there's a big, you know, range of ages, and there's this great podcast about McCarthy called Out Here by reporter Erin McKinstry, and she talks a lot about that as well, and how these people all have really different sort of personalities and backgrounds and inclinations, but they're kind of bonded together by the uniqueness of this place. And there's a moment in your book where there's two characters, Maxine and Bonnie, who kind of have this moment where they are commiserating about how hard life is out there. I mean, you know, what's kind of the glue of this community? What is there a through line that brings all these people together?
Well, I think they do bond from the hardship, certainly. I mean, I love that scene from where Bonnie is, like, she's trying to build a log cabin with her boyfriend, and they've, you know, it's February and they've only got two rounds of logs up, and they're living in a wall tent where the laundry is all frozen because they can't keep it warm. And she goes over to visit Maxine across the river, gets her feet wet as she wades across, and, you know, in some overflow, and she goes in, and Maxine, having, you know, been through that period herself years earlier, says, "Would you like some chocolate cake?" You know, and she, Bonnie, bursts into tears and says, I can't take it anymore. Did you ever cry?" And Maxine says, "Honey, when I realized what I'd gotten into, I cried for the first 5 years I was out here."
It's such a good scene.
Yeah. So they supported one another. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that was kind of what was so devastating about the murders, was that so many of the older folks who had really been, you know, the glue of the community were killed by this guy. And Maxine in particular, you know, being one of the ones who I start the whole book writing about her death, and how I had to go off and track down her son in Anchorage and give him the news.
Yeah, you don't talk about that specific moment you talk about the build up to that moment when Jim asks you to track down his son. Was it hard to find him and tell him that news? Kind of what was that like, going back to Anchorage and then having the weight of this?
It was awful. Yeah. You know, but it was, as I write in the book, it was so weird, because part of me recognized, wow, have I got a great story. I'm going to be like the hero when I get back to the newsroom. You know, the police reporter, you have that. That's like what I was talking earlier about the insider and outsider in a writer. And the outsider was the police reporter saying, wow, this is a hell of a story. You know, this place and what happened and everything I just learned. You know, so I was writing it on the airplane during the charter flight back across the Chugach to get back by deadline. But first I had to go find Steve and tell him that his mother was among the ones who were dead. Because there was no, back in those days, there were no cell phones, no communication out there, really. And I was carrying a note from Jim Edwards to his son. He was easy to find. And I gave it to him. And he said, yeah, I kind of thought this might be the case. And that's all I remember, except that Steve kind of disappears from the story until the end, where he's there at the memorial for his father in 2016. And so I kind of end the book with him. Mm. And I feel like writing this book was a way of restoring the stories of his mother and of that period, giving her back to him a little bit. So, and he was very helpful in, writing, finding her old letters and things and photos to share in this book.
You reference a lot of letters and journals and newspaper articles in your book, including from, Rick Kenyon's McCarthy newspaper. How cognizant are you when you're writing that your work and your stories, are used for this historical record? Does that kind of impact the way you think about the writing process?
That was always my, to back away from McCarthy. That was I had 25 years as a reporter at the Anchorage Daily News, and the stories that really excited me were the ones that seemed to be stories of this historical moment in Alaska. I had a feeling ever since I got here in the 70s that I was fortunate to be living through a moment of historical transition, and those were the kinds of stories that I was interested in as a sort of American studies major from college. This was my my field of play. So when I was covering the Kenai Peninsula, for instance, I was shared with you that the series that I did in 1991 about the Kenaitse people, and that was certainly, a big Kenai story. The city was celebrating its bicentennial. And I think that the sort of Chamber of Commerce consensus was that this had been a great period when the Russians had arrived and brought civilization to the Kenai Peninsula and, 200 years of progress. And they'd gotten a big grant to develop the Bicentennial Visitor Center. And I wrote this 8-part series that took, credit the ADN that they let me work on this for a couple of months, but it was a sort of the 200-year history of Kenai as seen from the point of view of the people who were standing on the shore when that first Russian ship showed up. And there were two families, the Kalifornsky and the Ivanov families, and sort of was able to piece their generation by generation story through this series. And it's, there were some wonderful, uplifting moments, but on the whole, it was a very sad story until the end, when there seemed to be a kind of revival, kind of triggered in a way by the bicentennial and by the sort of blithe sort of dismissal of the people who, the first people. So the whole series was called The Invisible People. And I think I got that probably from Claire Swan, there was later a big exhibit at the Anchorage Museum that they called The Invisible People about the broader community of the Cook Inlet Dena'ina. And Aaron Leggett, who organized that, told me once that he was a teenager growing up in Iqaluit and read that series, and it kind of clicked a light bulb for him, like, oh yeah, our people, we kind of just rolled over for so long and couldn't speak up. And so that was a really rewarding project to have done, but sure. It also got the Anchorage Daily News boxes banned from the Kenai Visitor Center for a while.
So. Well, and before I ask the next question, where can folks find that series if they want to read it and they're listening?
I have it posted on my website, okay. And in the 2017 Kenai Peninsula History Conference proceedings, they reprinted that series. It was called 150 Years. Mm. Shauna Loshbaugh was the editor of that, and I think that's probably available locally. Mm-hmm. By the way, speaking of available locally, I'm going to go over to River City Books this afternoon from 1 to 3 and sign books for the Cold Mountain Path.
Yes. And we'll remind folks of that at the end of the show as well. You mentioned Claire Swan, who was the tribal chief for Kanaitse in 1991 at the time of the bicentennial, I believe.
She was essentially, mm-hmm. but I don't know if technically.
Got chief. It. But in this series, there's this great part that you reference where she kind of says, you know, you say you want to hear real Alaska Native history, but when it comes down to it, you don't want to. You kind of just want your own version, your glossy version of the history, you know, this mythology that you've kind of told yourself for years. Feels relevant today for a lot of reasons, including on a national scale, as we're kind of having these conversations about our history and our dark history. But also locally or statewide, Alaska history does present as pretty romantic. And I think it's easy to kind of romanticize the history of this place on a surface level. I mean, do you find that there's a disconnect between the romantic ideas people have about the state's past and its actual past? And, you know, it seems like maybe you even see that as part of your job as a writer and a journalist to kind of bridge that gap there.
Yeah, I think that is what I write about a lot, is the difference between what we think we're doing and what we're actually doing. I mean, I think we're in a modern era with national parks and tourism, and we can't really pretend that we're not. You know, I think it's just, it's hard to know what more, you know, like the Pilgrim story was really that kind of a story where they were using that old mythology he was just shielding the, you know, brutal, life that he was subjecting his kids to, and using a shield of pioneer mythology, and a lot of people signed on to sort of say, oh yeah, you know, he's kind of the good old American frontier hero,
right?
But that was just a facade, and so try to tear back those facades a little bit.
Yeah, using that mythology as a shield, that's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, it's also a shield for the, like I said, the reality TV shows, and you know, we a shield for, I don't know, we sort of romanticize the oil industry for its sort of rough and tumble frontier, you know, drilling, bringing new jobs and possibilities to the Kenai area, but it's a different story on the sort of declining end of that period, and you want to make sure you're not making your political decisions based on the mythology of the upswing period. I don't know. I mean, just trying to think of ways to maybe apply that.
Sure, locally. To draw that line.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left, but one of the last things I wanted to ask you is, of course, you know, we don't have a crystal ball, but what do you think the future of McCarthy looks like? You know, you stop at the Mail Day murders, and then you kind of revisit this period in 2016. You know, going forward, you know, what would be the next chapter that you think you'll be writing in the history of this place?
I don't think I'm writing another chapter. I'll leave that to somebody else. You know, there's just a evolution toward sameness in the world, and McCarthy hasn't succumbed to that yet. So I hope whatever factors can be brought to bear to keep it from becoming just another big tourist hub, I hope that will hold off for a while. I don't know. It's like I said, it's a small area, actually, physically, so it can't really accommodate huge huge crowds. I'm not sure if what it would be like to get overrun. I get a little nervous when I hear the state saying, well, Denali's too busy. We need to channel people down to Wrangell St. Elias. I mean, it's the biggest national park in the country. It's 13 million acres. But the actual places where you can get out of your car and stand are limited, you know. And I've spent a lot of time in the backcountry flying in or hiking in. And there's a lot of wonderful country there, but Americans like to sort of move 50 feet away from their vehicles, right? So that can't really be accommodated out there indefinitely. Right now, it's kind of at a nice equilibrium. I hope talking about this book doesn't bring too many more visitors.
Well, if you do want to go pick up the book, if you're hooked after listening and you want to go buy the book, Tom will be signing copies today at River City Books in Soldotna between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. And that's about all the time we have today. Thank you so much, Tom, for being here. And thank you for listening. You've been tuned into the Kenai Conversation. I'm Sabine Pooks.